Welcome to Sinopinion, the podcast of the Center for International Security and Strategy at Tsinghua University. We provide Chinese perspectives with a global vision. I am Da Wei, the director of the CISS, speaking from Prague, Czech Republic. Over the past decade, Confucius Institutes have been a flashpoint for debate. On one hand, the Chinese government aimed to promote the Chinese language and boost its soft power through their institutes and classrooms. On the other hand, in many Western countries, Confucius Institutes have been labeled as sharp power, tools for expanding China's political influence. Some politicians and media outlets claim that they undermine academic freedom and export the China model. This backlash has led to a wave of closure across the West, reflecting the strained relations between China and the Western countries. Today, we are honored to have Professor Michael Jinghan Zeng with us. Professor Zeng is from the Department of Public and International Affairs at the City University of Hong Kong. Before he moved to Hong Kong, he spent 13 years studying and working in the UK. At the age of 31, he became a professor of China and International Studies at Lancaster University and served as the director of its Confucius Institute. What makes his story unique is that he was a Chinese national serving as a local director for a British university, a fascinating role to say the least. In August 2025, he published his book with Palgrin Macmillan titled Memoirs of a Confucius Institute Director, Volume 1, Challenges, Controversies, and Realities. This is the first insider memoir of its kind. I'm also very pleased to hear that the second volume of Professor Zeng's memoirs is coming out soon. On top of that, the City University of Hong Kong Press will be releasing the Chinese edition of his memoirs this month. The Chinese title is 孔子学院, 争议与现实. Welcome to our show, Professor Zeng. Okay, so to start, could you tell us a bit about yourself, specifically your education and career background across China, the US, and the UK? I think this will help our listener to understand the context of your journey.
Well, I think what I am trying to offer in this book and also in the story is based on my unique identities. And I was born up in China, the city of Chongqing, and I grew up in China. And I was educated in University of Macau, which is a city that west, mid, east, and you have very diverse culture there. And after I complete my undergraduate education in University of Macau, I went to the US for a master's degree. And after that, I went to work in United Nations in the city of New York. And I think there was some in the book, I mentioned a bit about those experiences and why I eventually decided to quit the UN and went to the UK for pursuing my doctoral degree. And I ended up working there as an academic and then eventually rise from the rank of lecturer, senior lecturer, and then become a professor in the UK and become a director of the Confucius Institute. So what I'm trying to offer in this book is based on my educational background as a Chinese and educated in American and Western universities and with considerable experience of living there as well. 3 years in the US, 13 years in the UK, and based on my identity as a director of Confucius Institute, as well as a professor of China and International Studies.
Wow, that's fantastic. That's very, your experience is really international. I was a kind of global citizen and actually work very perfectly with our, you know, this Sinopinion have Chinese root, but has global vision. So many people, including I myself, actually have a limited understanding of how Confucius Institute actually work. So could you explain your role as a director of a Confucius Institute? For instance, I know that actually a Confucius Institute is always a joint venture between a local university, so in your case, Lancaster University, and a Chinese partner university, and also the Confucius Institute headquarters. So I'd like to know which Chinese university was your partner university.
Right. So South China University College in Guangzhou is a Chinese partner of the Confucius Institute I work with. As you mentioned, it is a joint institute. So this would mean it was built between Chinese University South China University College and Lancaster University, and embedded into part of Lancaster University. And it was co-governed by a board, which was consists of members from both universities.
So how do you split the responsibility between you and your counterparts from China, and also, of course, the two universities? How do you split the responsibility? Or put it in another way, in a more direct way, you have two directors there, right? One is you, represents Lancaster, then the other is from China, represents your partner. Who had the final say? Who was the first director?
Right. Well, that's a very good question, and I think an important question to looking out. I think, as you mentioned, the very reason of why we have a Confucius Institute is there to promote cross-cultural understanding, is really to bring and bridge China's understanding with the rest of the world. And I think this joint partnership really helps that. You are having a British institution working with the Chinese institutions, and both sides has come together to co-govern this place. And I think this reflects the key mission of a Confucius Institute. So in terms of how it works, Lancaster University, or the host university, appoint its own representative, which is, in the case in me, as a local director. And then South China University College send its representatives from normally a professor as well, come to join us in the university. So it was co-governed by the local director, me, and a China director sent from South China University College. So on practice, we were working together. But obviously, because each Confucius Institute is different, this is a key point I'm trying to advance in this book project and future volumes. We should avoid too much generalization of it. In many places, the relation of a local director is called a director, and China director is called a co-director. And in Lancaster University, per the agreement we signed, a local director, which is my role, we called director. And then the China director sent from China is called deputy director China. So I think that signaled about different expectation of who have final say. And also, according to the agreement, it was a local director who is responsible directly to the Confucius Institute board. And it was set up there to ensure that we have a clear understanding of how things works. And in practice as well, I think normally the local director do play a very important role, because in many universities, local director is permanent. So in my role, for example, as a local director, I'm permanent. There is no term limits. This would mean that I can serve for 10 years or 20 years until my retirement. But China director, normally their terms is 2 years, and maximally they can renew once. So this would mean before 2022, they can only serve 4 years and they have to end. And after 2022, the UK government changes the visa regulation. They can only serve for 2 terms. So the influence of China director will be restricted by those wide range of factors, including tournaments, language skill, understanding of the local culture, understanding of the local environment, etc., etc. So this is a part that I'm trying to address more in the second volume of my book.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing with me those details. So I didn't know, but it's very helpful. And also, I think what you said, one point you mentioned is very important. That is, the Confucius Institutes are very different from one another. So we need to we should try to avoid generalization too much. I mean, that's a very key point that you made. So as you as you were a director at that time during your tenure, could you walk us through a typical day in your life as a director? So what do you do every day there? And also, what kinds of courses and projects did your institute offer? And how many Chinese teachers were there, and how do they teach? And who are your students? How many students did you have at that time?
Right. So I think as a local director, my job is not 100% on Confucian Institute. So like in the UK, normally our job are divided, right? If you don't have admin role, then you are 40% research, let's say 40% teaching, 20% admin. So in this role I'm having in Lancaster University, I'm having 40% of my job is being Confucius Institute director, and then 40% of my job is doing research, being a professor of China and International Studies. This would mean I'm very much like you in Tsinghua. I need to publish in papers, publish books, and attend conferences and get grants. And then another 20% of my job was doing another admin role, which is associated with this one, called Academic Director of China Engagement, which is helping the university to oversee our China partnership and support our engagement with China in general, including Confucius Institute. So on paper, I'm 40% doing Confucius Institute director. So if you translate that into the UK sense of what we call workload, then literally every 2 out of 5 days of my work will be focused on Confucius Institute. So that's something on paper. But what my work on a daily basis is slightly different because I'm being a professor and also other admin role as well. So I'm often travel time to time. I do not sit in my office every day. And I will go to my office, for example, if we have a meeting there or have other things to do there. And but we do have administrative staff, like our Confucius Institute manager, Confucius Institute admin assistant, who will be sitting in the office in the Confucius Institute building most of the days and supporting the kind of operation. And for director, we are basically focusing on the general direction, strategic direction of the Confucius Institute. So I think my role there is quite similar probably with your role. I know that you are directing a research center in Tsinghua as well. So it's very similar in that sense. So in terms of what kind of project we offer a wide range of projects in terms of engagement, teaching, and research. Let's say engagement. We do a lot of, let's say, calligraphy and also Tai Chi and different kind of Chinese cultural activity. And in Guardian of Research, we also function slightly like a small research center. We have annual Belt and Road Initiative conferences with colleagues from all across the world in China, US, UK, and come here for Belt and Road Initiative kind of conferences. And in terms of education, we also offer credit bearing courses as well as other extracurricular kind of classes on Chinese language, on Chinese culture, or different kind of things. We also have like tailored program for local business people. We are Lancaster University Confucius Institute is one of the largest in the UK out of 30. We have about 20 to 30 staff in total, and around 5 of them are the local staff, which are hired by local university, which is Lancaster University, and about 20 to 25 are sent by seconded from China. So some of them will be based in headquarters, which is Lancaster University, in the same building as I am, mostly facing the students who come from Lancaster University. And some of our staff will be sent to Blackpool or Carlisle, where we have teaching sites. Especially in Blackpool, we have two primary schools working with us, set up what we call Confucius Classroom. So they every week, they will teach 1 to 2 hours Chinese language lessons to the children there. So all the children in that school will have to learn it. In each of the schools, they have about 600 students. So this would mean in Blackpool, every week, we have about 1,200 students are learning Chinese from Confucius Institute. And in the first volume of my book, I talk about some of the stories of how our teacher has been helping the city of Blackpool to support the key workers' children during the pandemic time and during the national lockdown, which was very much appreciated by the local community. And we got a lot of very positive feedback from the local parents come to say that. Some of the parents say they choose to study in that particular school because we offer Chinese there. And they believe that China is the future. They believe their children need to have the ability to speak in Chinese and meet Chinese people, understand Chinese culture, and this will further develop their career and give them more options for their future. And that's why they specifically choose this school to study. So we have lots of stories like that and very much being appreciated by the local community there.
Huh, interesting. I think you must have a very busy job when you were there as a director and doing research and other administrative stuffs. So I really appreciate that. So in your book, you mentioned several challenges when you were the director, such as the COVID-19 pandemic and, of course, the political pressure that in the UK. Could you share some of the most difficult moments you faced, or some, you know, maybe some story that you can share with us during your tenure in terms of these challenges, these difficulties?
This can be challenging. And the reason I'm saying that is, you know, I have been doing this role for 6 years. And this probably is the most challenging 6 years for...
So 6 years, it's from which year to which
from
year?
From 2019 to 2025, last year. Yeah. So okay. This is probably the most challenging period, I would say, at ever since the Confucian Institute was founded in 2011. As you mentioned, we have going through three major crises, right? The first one is the pandemic. And I think in the book, I talk a bit about how the pandemic is creating lots of issues in terms of morals. Our teachers are very worried. They have a lot of mental health issues come associated with it. And we are not really, I mean, we need to provide a little more extra support and counseling for lots of reasons. And also there are racism issues towards Chinese in the city and in the UK and across the world. And meanwhile, the dissolution of Confucian Institute headquarters, that's another major challenge. Confucian Institute headquarters was the most powerful or probably most influential cultural organization and language organization in the world. It was the organization that translated Confucian Institute from a concept to a reality with a global network. And it just dissolved in the second year of my tenure. And that's something that I still now feel I wasn't so ready what the implication of that.
Was that a decision made by the Chinese government?
So basically there is a complicated, I think there was a complicated background behind that. And there was most of the because of the U.S. The U.S. by then has threatened to massively close all Confucian Institute. And I think my interpretation is this is a strategy to mitigate some part of it. So eventually the decision is yes, I think it was decided that Confucian Institute headquarters will deregister, to be precise, because we got a letter from it and mentioning that it will become deregistered. And then two new organizations will be founded. One is the Center for Language Education and International Cooperation, CLEC, and that will succeed Confucian Institute headquarters, but it will no longer be in charge of Confucian Institute affairs. Meanwhile, there will be a non-governmental organization called Chinese International Educational Foundation will be founded, and the management of Confucian Institute brand will be transferred to them. Even now, when I speak about it, it was very complicated to foreign audience, even for Chinese audience as well, because this was a complicated process. But at that time, it was even more challenging because we don't really understand what this precisely might mean and what this might mean for the future. There were some rumors saying that, you know, China is no longer committed to this and China will, you know, regularly cut funding to Confucian Institute. So lots of rumors, lots of different interpretation comes out. And that was quite challenging time. I think about 2 or 3 years when we adapt into this new organizational structure and gradually rise from the pandemic. And then another major challenge comes that Confucian Institute suddenly become the core of the debate, the leadership campaign in the UK. Rishi Sunak pledged that if he becomes the prime minister, he is going to close all Confucian Institute in the UK. And that suddenly exposed Confucian Institute in the very center of the politics in Westminster, and something that we haven't really been expected at all. And no one was really prepared for it. And it was such a minor issue in the past, but suddenly now become the core of the debate and become, you know, the key kind of campaign pledge that Rishi Sunak was making, trying to show that he can be tough on China. And that, as you can imagine, that created considerable stress in my ends, and I'm sure my fellow directors in the UK. So all sorts of external challenge, I think I have been talking in quite some details in the book, and complained with internal challenge as well. But I refer back to your question about what was the most challenging moment, I probably will say it was during the Conservative Party's campaign to ban all Confucian Institute in the UK. And in order to prepare for it, I had meetings with senior leader in the university, and I think in the book, in one chapter, I talk a bit in some details that by the end of it, we decide to prepare a contingency plan to prepare for the worst scenario. That would mean that if Rishi Sunak eventually becomes the prime minister, at that time, we didn't reach that stage, Rishi Sunak had that pledge. So we were quite early in that. But we did prepare for the worst scenario that, you know, if the worst is going to happen, how should we deal with it? What is the contingency plan to eventually close the Confucian Institute? What should be the procedure? What should be the process? And what should we do step by step? So I think that was probably one of the most emotional moments for me, because I have devoted quite a lot of my personal energy efforts into it, and also have those kind of, you know, I was thinking, how should I be facing my teachers, my colleagues and my teams, and, you know, tell them that this is the end of it, that is this organization we all work so hard to advance and support, and, you know, along with our professional life, and then it finally come to an end. Not because of something what we did wrong, but because of external perception of it. And many of them are wrong perception of us and come and force us to close. I just don't know how I can face them. So I think in the book, I talk a bit about the moment when I was in front of a computer and opened Word document, and I can only type in contingency plan. I cannot type more words of what should I do, right? It was a very challenging moment, an emotional moment for me. And I was sitting in front of the computer for quite some time and have my head empty and have no idea how could I do this and how could I, you know, communicate this and how could I follow this through. Those were very challenging times. And meanwhile, in those period, it lasted for a year or two for the entire Tory campaign to do it. And there was a lot of stress, actually, of preparing for different scenario and hearing about how things have been developing in Westminster, in London. And when I go back home, I would sometimes inevitably bring that kind of stress back home as well, which is not very healthy, I think, to my family. So sometimes I have to, when I drive back home, I have to park in my parking yards and stop in the car so I can have a moment of peace and reflected myself and stay in the car, trying to get myself more emotionally normal before I go back home and, you know, face my family and then talk about what happened in the day and prepare for another. So I think now when I think back, those were really difficult moments for me personally and also for my family as well, because those challenges were entirely out of your control. We have been doing quite well in managing the institute, and I think in the book I also talk about how those allegations are not really true, and many of them are based on false information. But this has been weaponized, used against us. And even if we manage it very well and avoid all the issues those allegations has been talking about, but this has done very little to change the external perception. And you feel quite powerless that regardlessly how well you do or how well managed the institute is, you still cannot control the fate of it. And I just feel this is quite unfair, and not unfair to me, but unfair to the institute and unfair to the teachers. And we have really done a great job and very much appreciated by the local community and appreciated by the children who has been learning it, appreciated by the parents, appreciated by the students. But unfortunately, those were not reflected at all. And it was a wrong perception that has been there, has been shaping the Kampf Institute, and has been shaping the 6 years when I served as a director. And this is also a reason why I feel that I need to come out with this book and talk to the world about what is a real Kampf Institute, what really happened on the ground. And also, I believe the purpose of this podcast is to show what we should really know about Kampf Institute instead of simply buying into those biased media or political allegations.
Wow, that's a very touching, stories that you shared with us. I can, I have this kind of empathy, when you told us that facing this very strong pressure, which actually not any individual can handle, well, you need to make a contingency plan, you need to meet your colleagues, you need to face your family. I think that's very touching moment. So thank you very much for sharing with us, and also sharing with us not only in this podcast, but also in your book. You already touched upon those allegations. So we know there are many popular narratives or wrong narratives about Confucian Institutes. Sometimes it's been called by politicians or media as propaganda machine. Some others label them as even spying institution. And some others say that the Confucian Institutes engage in kind of censorship or self-censorship regarding the sensitive topic of China. So in your own experience as a director, did you ever encounter those problems? And also, if you think those allegations are wrong, why they are wrong? Can you tell us the real story?
Right. So, I think what you just mentioned are the very common and influential allegations appears often in the media headline and a speech of Western politicians, and especially in the US and across many places. So I think we need to have a bit nuance there, right? This is why in the book, I have dedicated about half of the book to talk about those allegations. I think, number one, I want to mention that a lot of people in the community or Kampf Institute think that we should ignore those noise, right? Because those are not true, and engage with them does not really help. And those people don't really understand Kampf Institute. I understand where it comes from. And I also explain in the book why I decided to come out still to do that. So in each chapter of the second half of the book, I have dedicated several chapters to engage with those allegations. And on the first one, you mentioned about propaganda, I think a lot of allegations there has misrepresents what is legitimate cultural diplomacy, what is legitimate cultural engagement. And it is a very geopolitical double standard. For example, in the UK's context, the British Council has been operating in China and across the world. It was originally founded the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, still sponsored by the British government. And every year, the British government will come out to say a lot of good things about the British Council and how British Council has been supporting the goal of British national interests, and how it has been promoting British soft power, and how it has made the UK a top soft power. So why, if it's UK okay to use British Council to promote British soft power. Why is it wrong for Chinese to do that? And if you put in the context, the UK soft power in the ranking is much more higher than China. So, and in that context, it was not really reciprocal in terms of influence. And if you put that into more specifics, like the number of people learning Chinese, number of people learning British English, the number of people knowing about British culture, and the number of people knowing about Chinese culture in the UK, again, you will find this unequal influence. I decided to go to University of Warwick for my PhD, and a lot of my students, my fellow Chinese students decided to go to the UK to study. The reason is very simple, because we like the British culture, British, you know, value, British society, and because of the British soft power. And it offered a degree that was very attractive, right? That shows what? A very high level of British influence in China. So if that is okay, and British Council continue to advance that, why is it wrong for Confucius Institute to do the same thing in the UK? And bear in mind, if you really compare the number of students learning Chinese in the UK, is very, very low in comparison with the number of students learning English in China. And the number of British students go to China, the number is also very low compared with the number of Chinese students go to study in the UK. And indeed, in the UK, the largest cohort of international students are Chinese, and they are paying much higher tuition fee to study there than the home students. And why all of that, right? So I think there is a geopolitical double standard when we accuse Confucius Institute, you know, to do propaganda thing, blah, 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 while many other Western countries has been doing similar cultural engagement initiative. France, Spain, they all have their own program, state-sponsored program to promote their own culture. I don't think it's anything wrong of promoting your own culture and own language. So if Confucius is wrong of doing that, then the entire cultural diplomacy is wrong, and the Western country is doing that. So that's the first thing regarding that. The second allegation, and we separate that on the spying agency. I mean, a lot of American politicians are talking about it. If you go back to the former, the province state secretary, Mike Pompeo, and the current state secretary, right, Marco Rubio, both of them has been talking about Confucius Institute as a spying agency or helping spying in American campuses. And this one, it lacks of substantial evidence to support it. Basically, it's allegation without any systematic evidence to show or to prove that's the case. A lot of that is based on fake information and false information indeed. And despite that, it has become very influential and appears in many media headlines, major leadership speech, or even shaped the decision of close a Confucius Institute. There is no evidence to support it that the network of Confucius Institute work as a spying agency, right? That's the first point I made in the book. The second point I'm making in the book is that when we're normally talking about spying, right, it's often about this kind of high-level information about defense material, you know, military material. That's where you got the most value of intelligence. But Confucius Institute, they are based in either universities or in Lancaster University's case, we have based in primary school. The kind of information and intelligence the teacher are able to access are quite limited and not so valuable in terms of the intelligence community. So the kind of nervousness and anxiety that you have, you know, Chinese cultural organization in British universities might serve as spying organization, clearly exaggerated about what they particularly can do, you know. You don't really have so many classified information in a university context. And each university have their own, mechanism to govern classified information. And they are not the first places you would be going for spying. And the last point I made in the UK context is I'm trying to tell my friends in the UK, calm down a bit. UK is no longer the British Empire that is the dominating power, right? If China, first of all, every country do spying. The UK do spying, right? What is James Bond all about? You know, spying. But
The point is, the UK's strategic value to China is now significantly lower than it used to be. So Chinese interests in doing that in the UK, again, I think I'm being quite frank, quite limited, because what the UK can offer to China in intelligence world is limited. The interest will be mainly focused on probably the US and other more important countries. So all the kind of hype about that does not really make any sense. It has no evidence to support it. And in the UK context, exaggerated significantly about what it could do. And the third allegation, you talk about self-censorship and academic freedom. I think that is one probably we should pay more attention. And you do, I agree on that one. There are legitimate concerns about the potential impact on academic freedom. But I think there are several points to clarify on this. Number one, it's not only Confucius will do that. All kinds of external fundings to the British university will have the same kind of risk of affecting academic freedom. There are lots of examples of how, you know, American government funding or even British government funding or all sorts of kind of fundings potentially comes in with terms and conditions that might be affecting academic freedom. So I don't think the Chinese one is particularly unique. And single out the Chinese one and frame it as a problem, I think this is missing the context and exaggerating it, number one. Number two, I think in the book I also talk about how this issue can be properly managed, that with the Confucius Institute, we can still fully respect academic freedom. And there is no instruction from Beijing telling me that what I can do, what I cannot do. There is a lot of respect on the local agency, local university. And we have been running a lot of, you know, research and talks that touches upon those kind of sensitive topics. A lot of media saying will be absolutely not allowed in Confucius Institute context. And for more details, I would urge the listeners to go to the book and read it. So the point I'm making here on this one is I agree there are legitimate concerns about when you have external funding comes into the university, this might affecting academic freedom. But we have to put this in the context and perspectives that Confucius Institute is only one of them. Every time when a university accepts external fundings, there's always a risk, right? But does this mean that the university should stop accepting all external fundings? I don't think that's possible, right? So the point then there is how can we properly manage those risks to ensure that they have minimal impact on those issues. And I believe that the way how we have been managing it in Lancaster have provided a clear model and has mitigated those risks there. So it is an issue entirely manageable. And we should not use that as an excuse of leading to a kind of argument that Confucius Institute should be closed. And I think that misrepresents the point.
Oh, thank you for a very powerful argument. I think on the propaganda thing, I think you try to differentiate the propaganda from cultural diplomacy. Actually, all the country do, you know, promote their own culture. So why can't, if other country can do, why can't Chinese do that? So it's, yeah, I think in China, we always have this kind of sense of unfairness. So when the US or when the UK or when the Western country do something or doing it, we say it's cultural diplomacy. But if China do that, that's propaganda. So that's really not fair. And the spying thing, you offered a very interesting argument that actually there's nothing to spy actually in Confucius Institute or in certain countries. And I think your analysis on the self-censorship thing is quite, I think it's quite profound. It's something we cannot say, yeah, the Chinese side has done everything perfectly. I think every country have their own requirement for this kind of funding. Chinese side may have similar thing, but it's something that the Confucius Institute or the two universities can handle, can manage. I think that's a very important thing, very important point. Not just
ban Confucian Institute or open the Confucian Institute. How to manage it? This is something really we can. I think, I mean, all the institutes can try to handle with. So thank you for those, you know, very, very powerful perspective. So then you were on the position, actually you spent years in Macau, in the US, in UK, and you were in the on the position of the director of the Confucian Institutes. So let's imagine, this is a hypothetical question. If you were an advisor to the Chinese government, or if you had an opportunity to provide suggestion, advice to the Chinese government, how would you suggest the Chinese government to improve their effort in promoting the Chinese language or even broadly Chinese software? How can we make Confucian Institutes better, be better?
Right, I think that's a very important question and also something that I have been reflecting about for quite some time, ever since I'm writing the first volume of the book and the second volume of the book. Because previously, I wouldn't really be thinking about it. And I think indeed, I argue that something counters a conventional understanding. I argue Confucian Institutes should not only be understood as a soft power tool. The reason I'm saying that is there are three parties in the Confucian Institute organization. You got the local university and then the Chinese university and the founder of it. It was Confucian Institute headquarters and now Chinese International Educational Foundation. All parties have been contributing a bit. So maybe I think it's fair to say that the Chinese International Educational Foundation is thinking about China's national image and soft power a bit, which is state objective. That's fair. But from a local university point of view, let's say from Lancaster University point of view, we are doing Confucian Institute not because we want to promote Chinese soft power. It makes zero sense. Lancaster University wants to, and also other British universities, they host Confucian Institute not because they are interested in advancing Chinese state objectives, because we want to make the best of it, of the funding, to build our own Mandarin program. So Lancaster University is doing it for its own institutional logic, based on its own institutional logic, for its own institutional priority. That is not soft power. The soft power is a Chinese perspective. I think we need to clarify that very clearly, number one. Number two, is also because of that, we understand it's a joint partnership. So we need to really build about, okay, the China side wants soft power a bit, promote Chinese culture. The UK side, local side also want the development of Mandarin program. So where we can find the common ground, where we can build the link and overlap interest for the partnership. And I think that's very important part. And refer to your question, that is where we can improve to develop further. And this is very much like a diplomacy, right? When you negotiate, you need to understand what is your interest, what is your other's interest, so we can build kind of, you know, partnership build on that. And I think Confucian Institute is a small footnote of that diplomacy kind of work. So I would then advise China, really, I mean, the reason I'm also saying that I haven't really been thinking this only after, I mean, before I started writing the book, is because I was putting the head of the local director. And the local director is less thinking about Chinese soft power. It's more thinking about, okay, how we can build a better Confucian Institute program, the Chinese language program, cultural program, more local people who like it, engage with it, and all thinking about the institutional priority of the local university, right? So now I'm getting away with that hat. I'm now thinking about, as you mentioned, putting a hat on if I am the advisor for Chinese government, as you mentioned. So I would say, really, the key factor for Confucian Institute to succeed is their ability to adapt into local environment. And if you go back to, say, the several waves of closure of Confucian Institute in the US, you will find that some of Confucian Institute closed very early on, right? Even before there was geopolitical tensions. Some of them stand to the very last and become very resilient. And in the UK, the Conservative Party also appears quite resilient, despite of all those challenges I mentioned, despite the campaign they want to close it. And the very reason why is they embedded into the local university quite well. You got a local university who comes out, want to defend it, support it, and that is the key for the survival and continuation and resilience of Conservative Institute. Because only with the local support, it will have the roots that is able to weather the political climate. And I think what I have gone through will not be the last, you know, political climate against Conservative Institute. There will be more to follow. And the key to decide how long they can last, how long, you know, they can develop, depends on how they embed it into the local university, how they can understand the local environment and embed it into local environment. So my advice would really be, we should appreciate this joint partnership and understand about the needs and interests of local partner and work with them closer to ensure that this is a partnership that benefits from both sides, not only what China wants to do, but also what the local partner wants to do, right? Because they are the one who are providing the support, especially in Western countries where there are external pressure. So I think in the future volumes, I'm writing a bit more on this. I'm arguing that the reason why a lot of conferences closed in Western countries like Netherlands, Belgium, and Sweden, Norway, the UK continued to host the highest number of conferences. It was because of the British University. They have strong support and needs for Conference Institute, right? So that support is very important. So advice one then would be understanding about the needs of a local partner, local stakeholder, appreciate that and truly make this partnership serve as a win-win, not only China want, but also what the local partner want. And the second advice I would probably would give will come to more technical part, is I'm slightly reserved about the decision to dissolve Confucius Institute headquarters. And I think have being someone understand the Chinese political system quite well, decentralize a partnership and without a central agency actively coordinating it, without a state actor who is as powerful as Confucius Institute headquarters to support it, it creates lots, all sorts of administrative challenge. Many of them haven't even been solved. Even at the end of my tenure, 5 years after the Confucius Institute headquarters dissolved. So those are relevant to some administrative details, but I think I'm arguing that in the new model, there are a lot of administrative inefficiency, ineffectiveness, and also the Chinese university kind of lost their motivation in supporting Confucius Institute for lots of reasons. So from that perspective, then I did question a bit, okay, why are we doing that from the first place? Number one, it's not making the management and administration easier. Number two, it did not help. I mean, one of the reasons why we do that of dissolving Confucius Institute headquarters is to try to cut the state tie, right? A lot of argument is that Confucius Institute serve as extension of Chinese government, and the Confucius Institute headquarters is part of the Chinese government. It's part of the Chinese Ministry of Education. So that's why, you know, a lot of them has been viewing Confucius Institute negatively. So the hope by that time was to, you know, dissolve Confucius Institute headquarters. So now with a new non-government organization founded to manage Confucius Institute brand, so that it no longer have that direct state affiliation, so that we can fend off those critiques in the West about its state tie and state affiliation, right? But in reality, yes, we did all those organization changes, but that was not appreciated by the Western society. The critics continue to critique the same point. They just ignore those organizational changes, which was quite painful, by the way, as an insider. So it did not help to fend away those Western critics and then make administrative process and managerial process less efficient. Then why are we doing that?
And if we go back to that decision, I would say probably have like one clear cut of that might not be the best way forward. And if we are trying to do that mostly because of the US region, would it be possible probably to, you know, only have a regional response to what happening in the US, not doing that in the rest of the world? And indeed, by the way, even in the UK at the time, the state affiliation was not viewed as a negative thing by a lot of local stakeholders. They view it as a positive thing. And especially in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, many of the local stakeholders would want to have those state affiliation through Confucius Institute that will help their other institutional priorities. So now when you think about that, is that really the best decision we make? And what do we have achieved so far? I think that's something I'm still having a reservation now. Maybe things will eventually solve and become better a few years later, but I didn't really see that in my tenure. So the two advice I would really be given, to just to summarize, is A, respect and understand local partner, make sure Confucius Institute is ring-ring, and B, is when we make decisions about this global lateral Confucius Institute, right, we should draw lessons from it and reflect from it so we can move forward.
Thank you, Professor Zeng, for joining us on Sinopinion. If you are interested in Professor Michael Jinghan Zeng's story, you can find his book, Memoirs of a Confucius Institute Director, Volume 1, on Amazon and other platforms. In preparing for this interview, I was surprised to find that despite the closure in North America and West Europe, there are still about 500 Confucius Institutes running worldwide. In Belt and Road countries across Asia and Africa, the numbers are actually growing. Even in the UK, there are still around 30 institutes and 150 classrooms forming a massive network for Chinese language education. Regardless of how you view China's charm offensive, I believe that more people learning Chinese is a good thing. After all, mastering a language is the only way to truly understand another culture. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sinopinion, Chinese Perspective, Global Vision. For more insights from Chinese scholarship on international affairs, please follow or subscribe to our podcast. Until next time.